Thanks for tuning in for the January 26th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's feature interview is with Jennifer Frontera and focuses on neurological disorders seen in patients hospitalized with COVID-19. In the other segment, you'll hear an interview with Drs. Mahajan and Schuyler about the experiences and challenges faced by immigrant neurologists in the United States.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and today I'm talking with Jennifer Frontera. She is a vascular and critical care neurologist at NYU Langone, and today we're discussing the article that Jennifer and her colleagues published in this week's issue of the Neurology Journal titled, A Prospective Study of Neurologic Events in Hospitalized COVID-19 Patients in New York City. This is a report from the Global Consortium Study of Neurologic Dysfunction in COVID-19. Over the past year on the Neurology Podcast, we've covered COVID-19 from quite a few different angles. We're recording this just before Thanksgiving, and today we're going to discuss the different neurologic diagnoses that have been found amongst COVID-19 patients. So Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So obviously in New York, I imagine you and your colleagues have seen about as many COVID-19 patients as anyone. And before we get into the specifics of what you report in this paper, I'm curious what you think overall was the most interesting finding when you looked at the prevalence of neurological diseases amongst COVID-19 patients.
So when we started this project, which was really in March of 2020, very early in the New York City surge, you know, there was a lot of interest about direct neurotropism of SARS-CoV-2. Meaning direct neuroinvasiveness of the virus. And, you know, we were particularly interested in this because folks were complaining of anosmia, dysgeusia. There was syncope that people were describing prior to arrival at the hospital, which was really uncommon for pneumonia. And so a lot of us were thinking, okay, maybe there is a pathway that the virus is directly invading the brain via the olfactory bulb, or maybe they're having some medullary dysfunction that's contributing to the syncope that was being described. So we thought we were going to see more evidence of direct neurotropism. In fact, what we saw was a little bit more banal. Primarily, we were seeing complications of critical illness in patients that had severe hypoxia, acute renal failure. So we were kind of surprised that we really did not see much evidence of direct neuroinvasiveness of the virus. Not to say that it doesn't happen, but we really did not observe it in a relatively large cohort.
Great. Yeah. So I want to talk about how this study was performed. So, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but this was a prospective observational study, multi-sitter amongst New York City metropolitan area, where you looked at the prevalence of neurological disorders diagnosed by a neurologist amongst hospitalized adults with COVID-19. And as you mentioned, over a two-month period back in the spring. So what were the most common disorders that you did see?
We overall saw about 14% of our hospitalized patients had some new neurological event. So the way we did the study was basically we had a team of people that were putting together a cooperative study that is like nothing I've ever seen before. So we effectively were screening every patient seen by neurology across NYU Enterprise, which is really three main hospitals and an orthopedic hospital. So prospectively, we tracked our patients on a daily basis and went through and applied inclusion and exclusion criteria to them. So a little bit different than some of the other studies where they may have kind of cherry-picked cases or cobbled together interesting cases into a case series. This really gave us a more of a sense of how often these events are occurring. Because, you know, if you look in the literature prior to this, anywhere from 3 to 84% of patients with COVID were having neurologic complications. And so obviously that's a huge range. And so we found a much more kind of modest prevalence that I think is probably closer to the truth. The most common things we saw really were toxic metabolic encephalopathy. So patients with hypoxia who were encephalopathic, patients with acute renal failure, uremic encephalopathy, septic encephalopathy. These were all the most common, in fact, represented about 50% of all the new neurological insults that we saw. We also did see patients that had strokes, seizures, intracerebral hemorrhage. And I will say that the patterns of intracerebral hemorrhage were interesting and distinct. We saw patients that had a lot of microhemorrhages, particularly at the great white junction, which were really unusual. Overall, for intracerebral hemorrhage, however, it was very tightly correlated with anticoagulation. And back in the spring, we were affecting a protocol where basically folks would be fully anticoagulated with heparin based on D-dimer levels. Because we had noted that there was a high prevalence of thrombotic events in patients with elevated D-dimers, irrespective of, you know, whatever the neurological condition was. So we did have a fair number of patients When I say fair number, it's still very small. It was only about 20 patients or less than 1% of the entire cohort that had an ICH, but it did happen most frequently in the context of anticoagulation. And then the ischemic stroke folks, they were interesting as well because they seem to be more prevalent in terms of cryptogenic stroke mechanisms, which might be related to the hypercoagulability that we see with SARS-CoV-2. So those were some unusual findings, but again, largely secondary effects of the virus rather than evidence of direct neurotropism.
Got it. And to put it another way, one of the figures that you report was that roughly 2/3 of patients admitted to these hospitals during that time span with a new neurological disorder had COVID-19, whereas roughly 1/3 did not. Do you think it's fair to say that primary neurological disorders are relatively uncommon when compared to secondary neurological disorders in this case due to COVID-19? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think overall that's a true statement. When you look at the number of patients, we basically had found that about 948 patients were seen during that time frame by a neurologist and had new neurologic deficits as opposed to a recrudescence of old deficits or were a readmission for a tumor resection or something else like that that might not be related. And 606 of the 948, which is about 64%, had a new neurological event. That being said, you know, some of these are true and unrelated, right? So the prevalence at the time that we did this study was very high in New York City. So a lot of folks were infected just as a coincidence at the time that they came in with their new neurological event. So proving causality is difficult in these kinds of circumstances. And the fact that toxic metabolic encephalopathy, which was directly related to hypoxemia, directly related to the virus, was some of the most common types of problems we saw. Those are all secondary effects. So yes, it's primarily secondary findings. Even the strokes due to hypercoagulability or theoretically due to hypercoagulability would be a secondary effect as well.
Got it. One other finding I thought was interesting was that only 2% of patients developed any kind of neurological symptom prior to developing traditional viral symptoms with COVID-19, like cough or shortness of breath or fever. So in other words, if I'm understanding this right, if patients develop neurological symptoms, it was almost always at the same time as their traditional viral symptoms or even after the viral symptoms began. Is that accurate? Could you comment on that?
Sure. So that finding basically speaks to the concept, again, that most of these events are secondary to sequelae of having SARS-CoV-2 pneumonia, be it hypoxia, uremia, sepsis. There's always going to be issues when identifying time of onset of symptomatology, particularly within neurological patients, where you have to rely on caregivers to give a history rather than the patient themselves, perhaps due to their degree of neurological injury. But the fact that only 2% really seem to potentially have neurologic symptoms prior to the onset of ordinary or typical SARS-CoV-2 symptoms does speak to the fact that primarily we're dealing with secondary complications. Even amongst that 2%, you know, some of those patients, again, could have been true and unrelated, folks that had neurological events and subsequently developed COVID after the neurological event, but neither of the two are necessarily related. But I do think it reinforces our concept about most of this being sequelae of critical illness or severe pneumonia.
So I'm curious, did you see any instances of, you know, meningitis, encephalitis, myelitis that were related to COVID-19?
No, we did not. We had CSF PCR testing in 18 patient samples, all of which were negative, which largely parallels the general literature on CSF PCR for SARS-CoV-2. Unfortunately, as you probably know, at this moment, there is no FDA-approved test for SARS-CoV-2 antibodies in the CSF. Certainly, we know from West Nile that the antibody CSF test is preferred over a PCR test for that particular virus. The same may be true of SARS-CoV-2. We really don't know at this point due to limited availability of antibody testing. I have seen at least one report looking at antibody testing in the CSF. However, that only had, I think, 8 patients, and 7 of the 8 had serum titers that were higher than the CSF titers, suggestive of contamination rather than intrathecal synthesis. I think they did have one patient that had elevated IgG index, but that's very, very limited data. Ideally, moving forward, we would also have antibody evidence in the CSF to sort of back up the concept that direct neurotropic infection, encephalitis, meningitis, transverse myelitis, for example, are uncommon. We did see post-infectious complications, namely Guillain-Barré in our cohort. Other folks have described ADEM or acute necrotizing encephalomyelitis, which are post-infectious immune-mediated complications rather than directly related to viral invasion. I do think it's really important to kind of clarify what we mean when we say encephalitis. We don't just mean inflammation of the brain, but there's an implication of direct viral neurotropism and causality. And I think that's where some folks get confused in the literature in terms of conflating those two terms. And I've even seen people describe inflammation in the brain due to hypoxia, for example. Yes, those people get brain swelling. I've seen people call that encephalitis, which I think is misleading. So I do feel it's important that we sort of clarify what we're looking at. Overall, I think it should be reassuring to the general public and the population that neurological complications directly related to the virus seem to be exceedingly uncommon. And the secondary complications that we do see can largely be treated and potentially even prevented by really aggressive critical care management. In our population during the surge, and I think this is an important public service reminder, that our mortality rates were averaging about 21% in this cohort during this time when we were effectively practicing disaster medicine and we had surges of patients being treated outside of a normal ICU setting and really a system overload. These things can be prevented by general precautions, masking, social distancing, et cetera, that are probably more important now than ever. If you compare our mortality rates to a paper published by a cohort in Chicago during the same time frame, with the same percentage of folks being ventilated, which is sort of a marker of severity of illness from SARS-CoV-2, their mortality rates were 8% compared to our 21%. And a lot of that, of course, it's not an apples to apples comparison. Our cohort was a little bit older than that cohort, but you know, you cannot really overlook the fact that probably a lot of that excess mortality was related to the conditions under which we were practicing medicine. So any concept of trying to go for herd immunity or anything like that is really misguided, I think, because you know, we didn't achieve herd immunity in New York. It was like a free-for-all. Everyone was doing whatever they wanted to when we had this major surge. And so all we got from that was excess mortality. So I think it's an important reminder to people to just practice basic preventative measures that really are life-sparing and life-saving.
Terrific. Yeah. And as we wrap up here, Jennifer, I'm curious, any other interesting findings you think we should know about? So specifically for those of us providing neurological care to hospitalized patients with COVID, is there anything that we should be thinking of or doing differently?
Yeah. So I think we were overall pretty surprised by the range of presentation of patients with hypoxic encephalopathy, both from an imaging basis and also clinical presentation. So a lot of these people that were initially coming in, these quote-unquote happy hypoxia people who were not dyspneic and really did not even subjectively feel bad but had very low oxygen levels, a lot of these patients had sudden death and a lot of them also had encephalopathy. We saw a spectrum of patterns of MRI, evidence of hypoxic ischemic injury that, you know, is largely described in the cardiac arrest literature. But these patients were primarily hypoxic. Some of them also had some concomitant hypotension. There is a body of literature about primary hypoxia or hypoxemia being relatively benign, because there's literature in high altitude hikers and so forth where those patients seem to recover. But that's obviously a very different population than a critically ill patient who is hypoxic for prolonged periods of time. And so I think that this really, you know, opens up a new body of literature and a new approach to pure hypoxemia and the potential ill effects of it. The ramifications of that would really be in potentially ARDS management. And for a lot of these folks, we were trying not to intubate a lot of them early in the surge, but we may not be doing people many favors by allowing for permissive hypoxemia. Perhaps we need to be much more aggressive with them. Some people are looking at hyperbaric treatment, et cetera. I'm not sure that there's too much data on that, but I would say that the need for supplemental oxygen when people really start to get into saturations in the low 90s is probably a good idea. Retrospectively, we would probably be more aggressive in that regard than we necessarily were earlier on. Long-term implications of hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy is something that we're working on right now. We're collecting 6-month follow-up data for functional cognitive outcomes, including like neuroqual stuff like depression, anxiety, fatigue, sleep, and so forth, as well as cognitive testing to get a better handle on what the long-term implications of hypoxemia might be.
Terrific, Jennifer. Well, I thank you so much for joining us this week to explain some of these primary versus secondary consequences of COVID for patients with neurological disease. I encourage our audience to check out your paper. Again, it's titled A Prospective Study of Neurologic Events in Hospitalized COVID-19 Patients in New York City. Again, it was published in this week's issue of the Neurology Journal. Jennifer, thanks for your time. Thanks for working on this paper and also for taking care of these folks in New York. I hope you and your family and your colleagues are staying safe.
Thank you. Best wishes to you and your family as well.
Welcome to this week's What's Trending interview. I'm Jeff Ratliff from Jefferson University and the Neurology Podcast. We wanted to discuss an article that was published in Neurology Online in November 16 titled Immigrant Neurologists in the United States, The Path of Most Resistance. It was written by a number of members of the AAN's Graduate Education Subcommittee. Representing that team, we've invited Abhi Mahajan of Rush University and Erica Schuyler of Hartford Healthcare Iyer Neuroscience Institute to discuss the article. You guys mentioned in the introduction that about 31% of practicing neurologists are international medicine graduates. And of the international medicine graduates who are neurology trainees, about 25% are U.S. citizens or permanent residents, while the other three quarters are not U.S. citizens. The article outlines the unique role that international medicine graduates play in the delivery of neurologic care in the United States, as well as the unique path and hurdles they face in navigating both residency training as well as establishing their careers after training. Abhi and Erica, thanks for joining us, and thanks for your work drawing attention to the issues raised in this paper.
Great, thanks. It's great to be here.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for inviting us.
Erica, I want to start with you. One of our goals with the Neurology Podcast is to really think about ways we can ensure we're delivering fantastic patient care to neurology patients. I mentioned just now that IMGs are a significant part of the community of neurologists in this country taking care of patients with neurologic disease. So to help us understand the big picture, I was hoping you could outline for us the contribution that international medical graduates make to the field of neurology.
Sure. I mean, we need international physicians. They make really tremendous contributions to our workforce, both with their clinical work as well as within academic medicine. You know, as a residency director, I am humbled by the applications that I get. I get these applications from international physicians coming from top medical schools, from the top of their class. Sometimes they've had, you know, established research careers. Sometimes they've already completed a residency training in their home country, and they want to come to the U.S. to train here because of our specialized medical education and because of our research opportunities and opportunities to contribute to innovation in medicine. You know, so we need our international physicians as part of our workforce. And at the same time, the U.S. has a shortage of neurologists, with many areas of the country underserved and not having a great deal of specialized care. So in terms of the big picture, to me, it really defies logic that we make it so difficult for these talented physicians to come to the U.S., both to train here and then for those who want to remain in the U.S. to stay and really contribute to academic medicine to their full potential. So we really wanted to highlight these difficulties in our paper.
And Abhi, in the article, you guys discussed some of those long, expensive, and arduous paths that IMGs face in seeking residency training in the United States. Can you walk me through this? You mentioned in the article that only about 58% of IMGs who are seeking a PGY1 position are able to match into one, which compares to about 94% for U.S. medical school graduates. What are some of those barriers that Erica just mentioned that IMG applicants are facing?
So one of the goals of this paper was to highlight the journeys IMGs take before acceptance into residency programs. Of course, in addition to relocation to the U.S., this involves a customization to the U.S. health system. Some IMGs go through grad school or do a year or two of research, along with clinical observerships prior to residency applications, not only to experience the medical system, but also to hopefully get letters of recommendation towards the application. This means more time spent, money, navigation of the immigration system, and a lot of uncertainty. It's also important to note that the 58% statistic that we mentioned is through the National Residency Matching Program, or NRMP. This only includes IMGs who actually did get an interview. It might be hard to imagine this, but a portion of the applicants who apply may not even get a single interview. So the actual percentage may be even lower than that. Some of the barriers that IMG applicants may face include they may come from medical schools that are unknown and therefore underappreciated. The letter writers that they have may not be known in the field. The medical experience and research experience that they have outside of the U.S. may be underappreciated. And of course, there might be possible bias against IMGs as a whole, and that may contribute to this difficulty.
Erica, in the paper, you all describe the current status of international medicine graduates in current neurologic practice. You describe that about one quarter of practicing physicians are IMGs, with about 30% among US neurologists. When we look at markers of leadership in academics, you mentioned in the paper that almost a quarter of the department chairs are IMGs, and a quarter of those awarded the designation of fellow of the American Academy of Neurology are IMGs. So if someone's listening to those statistics, should they look at these and conclude that once an international medical graduate matches into and completes their neurology training, that they're able to transition to the neurology clinical community without issue? Or are there other barriers or biases that are present, even if not well captured by what might seemingly on the surface seem like reassuring statistics?
You know, so there are definitely barriers. With those statistics you just mentioned, given the high level of achievement of the IMGs that we are recruiting into the US, as well as the resilience that it really takes them to even make it into our pipeline, it's not surprising to me that our IMGs who do make it through the process are really successful and are having successful academic careers. However, I don't think all of them that want to or that are qualified to be getting to those successful positions are really making it there. And, you know, one of the reasons I know that Abhi talked about the difficulties for an IMG to match into residency. Let me tell you a little bit about the complexity of trying to stay on as faculty. So the type of visa that the vast majority of our IMG residents are using to be able to come to the US and train is called a J-1 visa. And the purpose of this visa is really for training only. And the goal of that training visa is that they return to their home country for a minimum of 2 years before attempting to immigrate to the US. Now, there are several ways to obtain a waiver of this requirement, and that's really what we're going for when we're trying to recruit one of our residents or fellows onto our faculty, is that we're trying to get a waiver. Now, the waiver process is extremely complex. It's cumbersome, it's illogical, and it's really not designed to meet workforce needs in any way. And, you know, it requires immigration attorneys, and it's not always successful. So because of these potential complexities, an institution may be hesitant to try to recruit IMGs, or it's possible that, depending on the location of the institution, they might be in a state that doesn't have waiver spots for specialty. They might only have waiver spots for primary care. So, you know, there are a lot of difficulties with trying to find ways to have our talented physicians remain in the U.S. An O visa is a possibility for obtaining an initial faculty appointment, but it also has its limitations. So the bottom line is that it's definitely doable to hire an international medical grad as a faculty, but there's room for improvement in the process.
Yeah, and I think the message that I'm hearing from both of you, and I'm glad you mentioned, Abhi, about that 58% match rate among IMG applicants to neurology residency or to residency doesn't count those who never interviewed at all. I think that's an excellent point. And I think, Erica, you're speaking to the complexity itself of navigating barriers of visas, which ones have a pathway to citizenship or to getting a green card, which ones do not. How onerous is the application process in itself with the legal maneuvering that needs to be done to complete those? I mean, I think both of those things are just hopefully some examples that I know you guys flesh out with a lot more detail in the paper. Before we wrap, Abhi, you guys mentioned at the end of this article, you title that final section as a call for action. And so for our listeners who read the article, or for our listeners who are listening to this conversation and saying, how do we change some of this complexity or knock down some of these barriers that IMGs face on their path to becoming neurologists? How do you advise those people? What can they do? Are there policies they can support at the level of national politics? Are there policies or protocols that they can advocate for at their academic institutions or at the clinical practice that they work?
Absolutely. So our call for action was basically targeted at a two-tier system, if you may. It was broadly twofold. The first one is to work towards mitigating any bias or any stigma against IMGs as applicants and trainees. Hopefully, with the information we provided with this article, programs and educators should feel comfortable assessing applications and should feel comfortable with the immigration requirements to hire the meritorious candidate that they do select for the residency program or for a job at their institution. The second point, of course, is the big picture point, which is aimed towards streamlining the immigration system. So advocacy efforts towards streamlining the immigration system are crucial. People who have already trained in the US on CMS funding should find it easy to work here and become permanent residents. Erica already mentioned the J-1 visa waiver process and how complex it is. While that process is complex enough, I think it should be mentioned that permanent residency or obtaining a green card, people from some countries such as India or China may be even more complicated, and they may find themselves waiting in line for up to a decade or more after completion of their 3 years of J-1 waiver. And these things matter when you're looking at the long-term health of a country and provision of neurological care. Addressing these issues would definitely help bridge the physician-scientist demand-supply gap and promote the health of this country. These efforts, therefore, have to work on an institutional and the national level.
I want to thank both of you. This has been a fantastic discussion. I appreciate the work that you and the rest of the collaborators put into this article. For our listeners, as always with any of our podcast episodes, there are more details and topics that we're not able to get to in this discussion. So I want to encourage all of you to please read the article. It's available online at neurology.org. Again, it is titled Immigrant Neurologists in the United States, The Path of Most Resistance. Abhi and Erica, thank you again for joining us on the Neurology Podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.